Welcome back to the fourth and final part of WCH Crime, the Columbia Eagle Mutiny. Where we left off last week, Al and Clyde had taken over the Eagle and sailed to Cambodia. They were hoping the Cambodian government would give them asylum and hold onto the ship to prevent its cargo, napalm, from entering the Vietnam War. Instead, a coup took place just after they arrived, and the two mutineers were taken prisoner. Eventually, they escaped the deteriorating conditions of their imprisonment, each going their separate ways.
It's the case of the successful two-man mutiny aboard the American munition ship Columbia Eagle.
Two crewmen were armed when they took control of the cargo ship.
The hijackers, meanwhile, went on to Columbia Eagle.
While Clyde went off into the Cambodian countryside to join Khmer communist guerrillas, Al was in a poor state of health and surrendered himself at the U.S. Embassy. He then had to face charges for what he'd done.
The shipping company and the captain were demanding the death penalty and that I be tried for treason. The U.S. government could not try me for treason, they claimed, but they could try me for the legal things that I had done that were against the law, which was mutiny on the high seas, assault with a dangerous weapon, armed kidnapping, things of that nature.
The Naval Intelligence Service officers who investigated the mutiny initially believed that more of the crew must have been involved, but Al was insistent that he and Clyde acted alone, and in the end, only Al faced charges. In total, Al was charged with 23 separate counts. But after some clever maneuvering from Al's lawyers, prosecutors offered a plea deal.
They could get a better deal, they thought, if I pled guilty, and they negotiated an offer with the federal government. The government didn't want a showcase trial. They wanted this thing slam dunk put out of the way. And it just so happens that I had a judge, and this is what my lawyers told me, that they believed that he was a Democratic judge and sympathetic, and that we would probably get a fair shake from him. They had negotiated. I didn't have to take the deal. I could have turned it down. But they said, we've talked to the government, and they're willing to have you plead guilty to two or three of the charges for a minimum sentence of 10 years.
Al's lawyers told him they couldn't guarantee that's what would happen, but he took a chance and agreed to do it. They were banking on the fact that the government didn't want to put up a fight that would have taken them to trial. Potentially, a trial could have been high profile and could have rallied the support of the anti-war movement, as apart from anything else, Al's charges proved that he wasn't working as a government agent. So Al pled guilty to two counts and was given the maximum sentence for each, 10 years for mutiny and 5 years for assault with a deadly weapon. Initially, the judge ruled the two terms should run consecutively, one after the other, rather than concurrently, as agreed with the prosecutor. But fortunately for Al, after objections from the defense and consultation with the prosecutor, the judge reversed his ruling and agreed for the terms to run concurrently. Despite all that Al'd been through, he was able to take a stand against the war.
We were in all the papers all over the world. Nixon had cabinet meeting and was talking about it. You know, it just blew him the fuck away. Why? Don't they love me? It was done politically. We made a political statement, and the government did their best to squash that political statement.
But in the end, Al did feel that his decision to plead guilty diminished that statement.
And I colluded. I colluded to help them to squash it by pleading guilty. If I had pled not guilty, I probably would be in the prison still to this day. And they could have convicted me on every single fucking charge.
So just 2 days shy of a year after his mutiny, on the 12th of March 1971, Al began his 10-year sentence at Lompoc Federal Prison. In an interesting parallel, across the Atlantic shortly after this, John Barker, the same age as Al, was also jailed for 10 years for his involvement with the Angry Brigade. And like with John, who we spoke to in our episodes 2 and 3, Al continued his resistance behind bars.
When I went into the prison, my first day in the prison, it was divided into different groups. On one side sat blacks, on the other side sat whites, on another side sat the Native American indigenous, on another side sat the Hispanics. And then there was a sprinkling of others someplace else. But the dead center in the chow hall was empty. I picked up my tray of food and turned around and looked and realized the only place I fit is in that dead center. And so I went over and sat at a table all by myself. And then slowly but surely, people got up from other places and walked over and brought their trays and sat down near me. And within a few minutes, there was probably 10 people. Most of them were resistors, anti-war resistors, or hijackers for airplanes or whatever. And so it was amazing. Some of them were just, some of them had been in the military and resisted. And so what happened was all of a sudden the center became this multiracial conglomerate. And every day, that's where I would sit. I picked the center. And every day it got bigger and bigger. And then by the time I got released, it was a mixed chow hall. That's not to say that it wasn't totally mixed. There was still segregation going on by themselves, but it was self-chosen segregation. And but it wasn't because of peer pressure. I was felt pretty good about that. Well, I actually got some neo-Nazis and some Klansmen to remove, not remove, but to cover their tattoos. That's not easy to do. What happens is you have to build bridges. You have to build connections. You have to have empathy. And you also have to understand their struggles. But more importantly, what I would point out to people continuously from day one, why are you fighting amongst yourselves? You have a common enemy. Your enemy is the person that has put you behind these bars. Your enemy is this institution where these guards are pitting us against each other. You have an enemy, and they are in your face every day.
As in London and around the world at that point, social movements on the streets and in workplaces spread to the prisons, where hundreds of participants in those movements were also ending up.
Over a period of time, we got improvements in the prison. We were able to get a better canteen. We were able to get a better education, better library. Things started to develop and change. Now, that's not to say that we did that ourselves. Those were certain laws were changed, but we were asking and demanding that they institute those things, that they make them occur. During that time, we started seeing more and more people were being arrested for anti-draft or anti-war. We had whether underground in there. They gravitated towards me because I was the first person in there that openly declared himself a political prisoner. There were other people that were a little intimidated to use that phrase.
Among the people Al met inside were prisoners of the Black Power movement and others who had been targeted by the FBI counterinsurgency program called COINTELPRO.
Los Angeles County Jail has a section, or did, called High Power Maximum Security Death Row. That was the name of it, High Power Maximum Security Death Row. One of the people that came in that they brought there was Elmer Pratt. That's his slave name. His slave name is Elmer Pratt. His nom de guerre is Geronimo. He was, I believe, the Minister of Defense for the Black Panther Party. He was also a vet. He and I met in a holding tank before we went up to that facility. He and I hit it off together.
Geronimo Pratt was a highly decorated vet who'd served two combat tours in Vietnam, being awarded two Bronze Stars, a Silver Star, and two Purple Hearts. He then joined the Revolutionary Socialist Black Panther Party, recruited by Bunchy Carter and John Huggins. Now, Carter and Huggins were murdered in 1969 by black nationalists being manipulated by COINTELPRO. Then Pratt himself became a target of the program, after the FBI said they wanted to neutralize Pratt as an effective functionary of the Panthers. Shortly after, he was arrested for the murder of a teacher, based largely on the evidence of a key witness, who later turned out to be an FBI informant, although his conviction wasn't overturned until 1997. With their shared commitment to the revolutionary movement, Al and Geronimo became friends. That friendship only strengthened after one day. The guards assaulted Geronimo.
He had done something, not any problem at all. He may have talked back to some guard, and they popped his cell open. And they rushed in with a bunch of guards and just beat the fuck out of him and drug him out. And so when this happened and the guards went running down there, I saw who it was that they were dragging out. I stood up at the bars and started cussing the guards and started to tell them, you know, fuck you, you punks, you ain't got no ball. You know what I'm saying? You know, you eat shit for breakfast because you're pigs. You know, start dumping on them when you see someone you know being drugged out. Next thing I know, my cell door's open and they're beating the shit out of me. And they drugged me off. They took him to solitary and they put me in solitary. So we were in cells next to each other in solitary confinement. We got a chance to talk at night and stuff, or during the day. We didn't have anything else to do. You're sitting there.
It later turned out that Geronimo was a good friend to have in the California prison system. One day, Al was put in a holding cell waiting for a court appearance with a number of other inmates, not all of whom shared Al's philosophy that prisoners shouldn't fight amongst themselves.
A couple of the blacks, thug-type guys, started to make a move on me because I was a rather small guy, at which point I looked up and I saw Geronimo in the next cell right next to us. And I looked at him and said, Geronimo. And he looks up at me, and those two guys stopped, and he looked at him, and he said, you all leave this fucker alone. Everybody in that cell moved away from the bars when he and I hugged each other through the bars.
Because of his plea deal, when Al got out of prison, he was still a young man. But Clyde wasn't so lucky. After his escape, Al never saw or heard from him again. And it's only much more recently that researchers found out what happened to him. US military investigators managed to build a likely picture of what happened to Clyde and Larry Humphrey, the military deserter he escaped with. This was built on by Roberto Leudemann and Richard Linette, who retraced Clyde's steps researching their book, The Eagle Mutiny, which then sparked renewed interest in the case. After Clyde and Larry got out of prison, they headed to the countryside to join the forces of the Communist Party of Kampuchea, who later became known as the Khmer Rouge, but at the time were known as the Khmer Communists, or KC. Remember that this was in 1970, a few years before they took power and murdered hundreds of thousands of people, so Clyde and Larry wouldn't have known exactly what they were getting into. But at the time, they thought they'd be welcomed with open arms for an act of rebellion against the American war effort.
It was an act that was suspect from all sides. Everyone suspected them of being something other than what they were. The Americans, suspected that they were communists. The communists suspected they were acting for the Americans, et cetera, et cetera. So they were caught in a kind of limbo.
They did get involved with the KC, but their status was somewhere closer to captives rather than members of the group. They were put up in a house near San Kay Kaun and given tasks like carrying ammunition cases around. They weren't given KC uniforms, but they went out and bought some themselves to wear. And some local people said they weren't allowed to speak with them. In their naivety, Clyde and Larry didn't appreciate that authoritarian communist groups typically demand the same sort of obedience as capitalist ones.
There was also something rebellious about McKay to begin with, in terms of he was always rebelling against the way that he was treated, because McKay had demanded equal treatment with other people who were part of the Khmer communist cadre.
In June 1971, in protest at differences in rations between them and KC members, they went on hunger strike for a day and a half. When this failed to move KC cadres, they tried to go to another village to find food and cigarettes, but were arrested.
The Khmer communists felt they just couldn't handle these two guys any longer, and they took them out into an area not far from San Kay Kaun, where they were killed, and their bodies were buried there.
There's more to the story of Clyde's remains in the bonus audio for this episode for our Patreon supporters. But the short version is that in 2003, US government investigators DNA tested bone fragments found at the site, and they were positively matched with the DNA of Clyde's mother and sister. The following year in California, Clyde's family were finally able to have a funeral and buried his remains in the family plot. As for Al, he served his time and is now more active than ever. He recently went back to Cambodia with his son, to see where Clyde ended up.
I flew into Laos, Thailand, and from Thailand into Vietnam, and we traveled all the way down, and we used the book that Roberto and Richard wrote to go to Parrot's Peak and track down the village where Clyde was killed and where his remains were recovered. And so we met with the villagers. We had a nice dinner with them, and they told us their stories, and they even took us over to the murder site.
That day in 1970, Al and Clyde were driven to do something extremely brave and extremely dangerous by the extreme circumstances and the dire human cost of the Vietnam War, which Al had seen firsthand. It had devastating consequences for both of them. Al lost his freedom, his family, and nearly his sanity. And Clyde lost his life. And in the end, the napalm made it to Vietnam anyway. But their rebellion did shock US authorities and contribute in a small way to slowing the flow of munitions to the region, and brought the anti-war movement to TV news and newspaper headlines around the world. and facing continued resistance from North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces, and escalating resistance at home and amongst service personnel, eventually the US was forced to withdraw. Shipping and dock workers can play a key role in anti-war movements. When transport workers get organised together, they can stop vital flows of arms into war zones. For example, in 1920, dock workers in England refused to load armaments for use by the Allies against the Russian Revolution. In the 1930s, dock workers in Australia and the US refused to load iron for the Japanese war in China. British dockers in 1973 went on strike rather than load British weapons to be sent to General Pinochet in Chile. And more recently in 2003, train drivers in Scotland refused to move a freight train carrying ammunition to be used in the Iraq War, which Al opposed as well. But Al and Clyde were on their own, which put them in a really difficult situation, as they couldn't just take part in a collective strike, say. Faced with those odds, many people would just either go along with the majority or maybe individually opt out of assisting the war effort. For Al and Clyde, they felt that wasn't enough. They paid a price for their actions. And was it worth it? For Clyde, we'll never know. But I did ask Al if he had any regrets, and this is what he told me.
Fuck no.
He did say, though, that he had wished they'd been able to take the weapons out of the war. But Al thought that the environmental cost of sinking the ship or blowing it up would be too high. Between his political activities, his day job, and his seasonal work as a Santa Claus, and a great one, I should add, it was hard for Al to find the time to do this interview.
I'm working with my old group, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, OSS. I'm also working with Veterans for Peace, the largest anti-war veteran group in the world. We have chapters all over the world. And if I'm not mistaken, we have an observation seat at the United Nations as an NGO. We have chapters in Okinawa, Japan, the Philippines, Vietnam, England, Germany, etc. We have chapters all over the world.
While the Merchant Marine is technically a civilian body, mariners are sometimes recognised as vets. In World War II, the Merchant Marine had a greater casualty rate than the US Armed Forces, and although typically denied recognition as veterans and the benefits that go along with that, merchant mariners from some conflicts have been recognised as vets many years later, basically once enough of them had died for the benefits to not cost much. Merchant mariners from the Vietnam War are not formally recognised as vets, although they are by Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
And I also work with Military Families Speak Out. Military Families Speak Out incorporates people and parents and family members that have family members that are in the military or may have been killed or may be still alive, and some that have completed suicide. There are currently 20.6 veterans that commit suicide every single day in this country. Just recently, the number, that's the recognized number by the U.S. government. There's no exaggeration, but we suspect it's higher than that because there's lots of veterans that are not taking advantage of the VA programs. And so they wouldn't be counted on those in those records. Just recently, I've returned from the silent march that we just did in Washington, D.C. to all the memorials, to lay the wreath that I sent you a picture of, to speak for the 20.6 veterans that commit suicide every day. I carried our national organization flag through the Vietnam, all the way through the Vietnam Memorial, and risking arrest in doing so. So what am I doing today? Does it sound like I'm sitting on my fucking thumbs?
So if ever you're in the US one December and you see a Santa Claus, know that it might just be Al, the only living mutineer on an American ship, and his rebellion against war, capitalism, and injustice is ongoing. Well, that's it for our first WCH Crime mini-series. We put a lot of hours into it, and we hope that it shows. Like we said at the start of the series, we've begun putting a lot more time into this and the Working Class History podcast, taking time off from our day jobs to make them better quality and better researched, and we'll be doing that through 2019. But in the longer term, we'll only be able to continue to invest this amount of time if we increase our number of supporters on Patreon, as we don't have any adverts or corporate donors. So if you value what we do and you want to support us, as well as get early access to episodes and bonus audio, like more information about Clyde's life and disappearance, go to patreon.com/workingclasshistory. If you don't have any spare cash, that's fine. Please just give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcast, or share our podcast on social media. We've also got links to more information and photos of the mutiny and related individuals in the show notes. Thanks so much to our patrons for making this podcast possible. This episode was written and produced by WCH and Daniel Waldorf. Audio editing by Daniel Waldorf. Music composed by Austin Coulson. We'll be back soon with regular episodes of Working Class History, and WCH Crime will return later in 2019. Catch you next time.